everyone. Welcome back to my podcast. And today's guest is Guillaume Bizat. I hope I pronounced his name right. It's always a challenge when I talk to him. But today we had a really good conversation. He's easy to talk to. He's the head coach of Le Mans, a freshly crowned Leaders' Cup champion in France. Also, he's the under 20 national team coach in France, which won 2 gold medals in a row. And today we had a lot of conversations about obviously staff, handling a staff, also talking to players, the cultural diversity of the French league. Also tagging up was a more tactical discussion, and he explained what the system he uses in his team and many more things. So as always, I'm very happy you're here. Please subscribe, please like, please comment, share, all the good stuff. And I hope to see you soon on the next episode. All right. Thank you. Bye. All right, Guillaume. Did I say it right?
Yeah, that's perfect.
Okay. Yeah, every time I see you, I was double checking. But not a common name to say, so I have to have better practice with it.
Yeah, it's William in the US, so that's why the American or foreigners, they say Guillaume, like in William, but that's the same.
Okay. All right. I was thinking before we start talking, I was thinking about my past 11 years with this job, but I was going into France a lot of times, and at least twice a year, sometimes 3 or 4 times a year. And I noticed a shift in terms of English language, in terms of mindset, in terms of openness, and more conversational than in the beginning of my career. Maybe I didn't encounter the people that are more open to the English language, but it seems like the English language is very much improving in France over the last years, especially in the basketball segment. Have you noticed the same thing? Obviously, you speak French to them, but have you noticed the same thing, that the younger generation, is it more English friendly?
Yes, the young players, but also I think the young coaches. I think the tools and all the social medias, all the knowledge in English, I think people have started to build relationships also out of our borders. So scouts are coming to France a lot. So it pushed everybody to talk more English, I would say. And with our first and second division, we got a lot of Americans. So we got to share also some of like the pedagogy in French and English. And I think day after day, it's pushing us. And I think we are willing also to develop more relationship outside of our borders. So English is first, I would say Spanish is second. Mm-hmm. And so we have to push that way also.
Yeah, and we talked before of the cultural diversity in the French league, but also in the French country. What about the blending of cultures within the French league? You know, we talked a little about it, because there's French, American, and African roots, obviously, right? Is that's the three that you referred to when we had discussions about it?
Yeah, and European roots also. Yeah. I think that's a good mix of different culture. That's why also we are a stable country. The championship is stable, and when foreigners are coming to France, they can find somehow people to talk to, and also similarities in terms of ethnicities. For Afro-American coming to France, I would say it can be more friendly at first sight when you arrive in France to be in a team surrounded with over Black European, Black African people.
Yeah, it's very you know, you see the diversity, you know, especially with the African roots coming in, and then the blends in terms of the physicality of the league. You know, like, I don't know how you view the French league, but like elite league, in comparison to other European leagues. I would be curious to hear your mind on your thoughts on the comparison with other leagues.
I think that despite our budget have not increased that much in the past years, it's more like also stable. But I would say that the quality of the local players, the athleticity of the local players, is certainly higher than everywhere else in the world outside of the US. That's why the competition have increased in the past years, because we got now more team in the EuroLeague, team in EuroCup, team in European competition. So it helped us to bring more talent to the league. But if we can compete, and if the teams can compete in those levels, it's because the local players are perhaps a little bit better, or perhaps a larger spectrum of players than in a lot of countries. Mm-hmm. Even with a lot of guys going to the NBA, going playing outside of France. Despite of this, we got always new talents coming and ready to play. And we can see it because at the EuroLeague level, just a few days ago, the top three young players of the EuroLeagues are three French guys. So, mm-hmm. and people who have not played in the EuroLeague before. So that's really interesting to say, okay, we got like all those like 2004, 2005 kids who have been drafted to the league, but despite this, we still got a lot of kids who are in the EuroLeague and playing the right way and making a good season.
Yeah, it's profound of how many French kids come out every year, and it's just like a production company, you know, like one talent after another. Do you think that's also testament to French coaching in regards that the coaches education is right, going the right direction?
I would say it's part of the system. Like first, the French Federation invests a lot of money in the selection and the practice of the young kids, like at starting at 13, 14. A lot of kids all over France are starting to practice one or twice a day. And then the professional clubs are, after taking the lead, from U16 to U21, and plus INSEP at the same times. And I would say that system is complete, because when the kids arrive at a level that where they can play and compete against professional or adults, they can play National 1, they can play Pro B, a couple of them got spots in Pro A also. So And the FIBA report every year is showing that in terms of minutes for the U23, we are the best country. And I think it's related to that. So, of course, you need coaching and you need teaching. But the system, I think, is our best strength. And after, the second strength is that the coaching I've developed with the development of the players. Because when you start coaching better players, I think you push yourself. And you want to improve, you want to compete, and you got good teams, so you can compete against higher level at the INGT, in the U16, U18, or the youth categories, FIBA youth categories. You can compete against the best, and so you improve also. And and after that competition, I would say healthy competition between the coaches have also push us to work a lot, to work together, and perhaps change the mentality of how we work. Before, France was perhaps a little system where everybody want to keep his secrets. Mm-hmm. And now I think a lot of coaches are really more open-minded, open to share, and it changed a lot.
I think that's the biggest overrated fact that coaches used to do, is just not sharing, you know, like the secrets that everybody keeps from each other. Everybody watches the same games, and the most you can keep a secret about is maybe a preseason game behind closed doors, you know, or a scrimmage that you don't want to get out, you don't want to keep any statistics, and then that's fine. But in terms of thought, you still have to like implement those things that to your team, you know, that if you want to steal an idea, which we all, when we watch games, we steal plays, we get ideas, we get inspired by other teams all the time. So just holding information back, whatever that information is, that, you know, you may want to hold back certain injuries your players have, or some, you know, some traits that you don't want to share at that moment. But in terms of how you view the game, how you see certain situations arise, and how you can use those situations, doesn't mean that you can use that on your roster. You know, it's just the players are different. So you also always have to adapt. Coaching is such a hard job and such a mysterious job, because you always have to adjust, you always have to adapt to what you got in front of you.
Yes, and I think stealing is every day. The other day I was watching an interview about the coach of Nymburk, and he was saying his team is effort oriented, and his way of seeing basketball is like total, and it's effort oriented, and it's not defense, it's not offense, it's effort oriented. And I thought that this tagline was really meaningful, so I steal it, because he refers a lot of what we do, and I use it like perhaps the day right after with the team in a speech, like to be team oriented, effort oriented. And I think we're stealing every day, but after is the consistency, like the pedagogy we use to put it in our system, because he has to be crystal clear when you explain it to the players, and he also have like need a coherence, like coherencia with everything you do, and after the consistency of this, like are you going to be able to manage it every day and do it every day, and that's why you can't do everything. You need to select, you need to reduce, and you need to make it clear for your players, because it's good to steal and add. And I think we coaches take a lot of pride about this, but sometimes I think people can and players can be overwhelmed with all the information we're giving. So we need to be really pay attention to that.
Yeah, the filtering process is important in terms of how much you chop it up and chop it down, and then make it digestible for every player. Just to get back on the players, I do agree that it's about opportunities, basically what you're saying. Like the kids have opportunity to play, and that's where I think the French system has an advantage over a lot of systems, because the gap between 18 and 21, 22, where a lot of kids go into pro basketball too early, they sit on the bench, they are not able to, even in practice, to go into the rotation. You know, they're out of the rotation. They just basically do the warm up and sit on the side and clap, or sometimes they get a couple possessions. But in France, the Espoir League, where you can play against your age group and against older kids that are not, you know, grown men, but they're already older and mature. And this is the gap that college basketball has also, you know, like this is the age group that you can play basketball at the next level amongst your peers. And that gives the opportunity for, you know, implementing everything you learn, implementing everything you practice, where other leagues don't have it. They have in Germany, you know, a Pro A or Pro B league, where you play against pros already, and sometimes you're physically not mature yet to play at that level, even though you may be talented enough. Does the French league give out bonuses for playing time of young guys?
We had that system during a few years, and now they are rethinking the system. They want to do it again, but in another form. I think that's good to push, but do we really need that push? I don't know. I think if it's your culture, and if you build up a system to incorporate young players into your system, I think the league doesn't have to have the leadership on this. I think that you can have your own vision, and you can build around this.
Yeah, it shouldn't be an incentive to play the young guys. It should be a bonus, right? It's you should play the young guys if they deserve to play, if they're ready to play, and then it's like there's an extra reward on top of that. You know, on top of the player getting better, the club also gets some money back for the development. I think that should be the thought process. It's not like you should put the young guys. The club shouldn't push you to put the young guys on the floor.
Yes, and after that's also a question of like consistency of the opportunity. Like when you take a young guy and a young player, and you have a project with him, that's really hard to throw him into the fire, into like desperate moment, or like when you're winning by a lot and without consistency. I'm a strong believer that you need to have, like, even with a young player, if you want to develop him, like perhaps two windows, one in each half, and after you can build around this, and when he's starting to do better, you can add a third one, or stuff like this. And this way, he can also know that he's part of it and he's building on it. And step by step, I think on this, you can have like constant feedback with him and you can improve around this.
Mm-hmm.
Because playing time is the first key. And the second key, I would say, are all the vitamins that you do before and after the practice to build up on those things. Like, and having an intention on those moments, a strong intention to practice like precise areas.
So you did coach under 20s 2 years in a row, gold medal, right? So
yes.
Has it been done before? Did you make any research on that?
in men's basketball, no.
Yeah, but the under 20s to have these back to back wins and keeping the guys engaged, keeping the guys motivated from one summer to another. What do you think was the biggest progression and the biggest advancement in that summer in between, in that year in between, but then the second summer going into the second championship last year?
I would say first is the mentality of the French players. Like when they come to play for the French national team, they come to compete, yes, but they come to win. And I think like 10, 15 years ago, that was not the global mentality. Like, it changed a lot. But it's one thing to say it, but after is to put the work in front of it,
mm-hmm.
and to have like also the condition to do it. So thanks to the French Federation, we are in good condition to get ready. We can make like a tournament, like for example, the 2 years, we went to a tournament, in the south of Spain. So we have played against Lithuania, against Israel, against Spain, of course. And it's always challenging games and it gets you really ready, not for the first round, but to the second round, because in 3 days, it's like you're playing already a quarterfinal, semifinal, and the final.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of energy, a lot of intensity. You can test your players and in those moments, you can really manage and challenge them. So I would say during those 2 summers, the most difficult was like to build up a team to win, and after to like have to restart with complete new players, and to we want to keep some stuff from last year, but we also need to be open enough to adapt to the players we have, because they're not the same. They're not the same on the court, and perhaps even more important, they're not the same outside the court in terms of personality. And if we want to bring them into the project, we have to work differently. And he has been two completely different summers, because the first year we were like a really dominating team, like the everybody was playing between 12 and 19 minutes. Only in the final, people have played over 20. Before that, the 12 players were playing so much, like the team chemistry was really, really high, and the numbers were crazy. But even despite of this, we only won against Israel after overtime in an epic moment. but the summer after, it was more a struggle, because the roster was perhaps a little bit shorter, and the level of talent perhaps a little bit shorter also, and we have to build more into around key players and try to build up the confidence around them and in tough moments. And we lost one game in the pool, and I think that loss against Serbia have helped us win the chip so much, because mm-hmm. it has been a brutal truth moment where we had to like go really deep into ourselves, into players. And after we had the leadership of Noah Penda, even Zachary Perrin have been tremendous down the stretch. And after a few X factor, and we managed to take it against Slovenia.
Yeah, what But national team is a very short summer. You know, you cannot basically. There's only limited time you have in terms of developing, in terms of implementing something. What do you think is the key things that you can have the biggest impact on as a national team coach?
The intentions, like you have to pick up your topics and say, okay, we want to be the leading nation in those areas. Like that's not negotiable to be. And for us is to be constant ball pressure. Is to have like a really high impact on the offensive rebound, is to be able to play around every opportunity, pushing the tempo and playing up tempo on every situation. And after, the fourth one is the sharing of the ball, and sharing of the ball, but with an intention and an intention to shoot. And perhaps in the last 2 years, where we have worked the most daily, because it's not natural, perhaps for French players, and we're pushing to go more in that way, to have a stronger intention to shoot the ball, to not put it on the floor right away and stuff like this. And so that's a key point. That's four key points for us. And so we track this every day, at practice, in games, and for us, like. The first question on every time at halftime or when we go feedback, doing some feedback about the game, say, are we in our DNA? If we're not, we get to put different people on the floor and go in our DNA, or pushing the guys to go in that DNA. And after the second part is to build a comprehensive system where we can jump back on what we want. So terminology is a key thing also, to make it simple, understandable, and this way we can build up on this day after day.
Hey, quick interruption, and I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. I just wanted to make sure you're aware that on July 8th in Vilnius, Lithuania, there will be a summit happening that we're organizing. It's going to be a podcast-style conversations with some of the top coaches like Vincent Collet, Andrea Trinchieri and Yanis Feropoulos, other specialists from their turf, not only coaches, but you'll be able to have Q&As with them. We're going to have workshops available. You can find all the information on www.b8summit.com. You can buy tickets there, and there's still some standard tickets available. Three workshops are still available with Kostas Chatzichristos, who is a strength and conditioning coach for Fenerbahce. So we have lots of good stuff there happening. And it's the first of its kind in Lithuania. I'm very proud and very happy that we're going to do it. And I hope you're there too. See you soon. So terminology is a good key point, key factor for players, but also for the staff. How do you form the language, the terminology for your staff also, not to get confused? Because, you know, you can say, we step out, we hedge, we show, like it's the same thing, but you like for the players to have a clear idea and all the time to be repetitive, so the language is the same. How strict are you with the terminology?
Yes, that's really important, because I think if the players owns the terminology, after they can talk and debate about the details. Like, for example, we were big on step and plug. So when we do this, okay, we need to determine, okay, we are aggressive on the ball. We want to stop the ball. The guard step over the big. But there's a moment where we need to reconnect to the players. Like the big is going back and the guard is going back on the ball. And this moment is, or you can teach it, but people have to experience it, play it. And if they start understanding what you want, you can drill it, you can show it on the video, and they can talk to each other to make it clear. Because that's important, that's clear from coaches to players, but between players, and especially big and guards relationship, it's really important that they learn how to communicate and react through the plays.
Yeah, it's a like foundational knowledge, you know, and then you can build on those things. When you think of putting yourself in the transition for yourself from under 20s to Le Mans to, you know, Pro A, winning the Leaders Cup, like high-end professional basketball club, what doesn't translate from let's say under-20s, which is still, you're already adults, you're coaching adults, but they're still essentially junior players that are just transitioning into professional basketball. What doesn't translate from under-20s to high-level pros?
I think young players, they are more willing and more open to try a new experience. Like, for example, to express themselves about what they see, what they feel. And we have a lot of open space with the team, with the youth players, with the young players to really appropriate the project, because we want to acculturate of in that way of doing. And with older players, when during 15 years of their career or something like that, they are not used to do it, that's going to be a big challenge. So you can't go that far, that fast. You got to go slower. And also the difference is the timeline. When you work during 6 weeks with players with like a strong goal that everybody can see, is different than when you work from 15th of August to 15th of June. Like 6 weeks to 10 months, that's a big difference, especially when in front of you, you got adults with family. Yeah. A lot of are away from their family. So there's some down moments. Into 10 months, there will be some down moments. Where in 6 weeks, there's less of this.
Yeah, you can keep, there's still going to be up and downs in a 6 week period, you know, but it doesn't fluctuate as much, you know, where in the professional 10 month season, you can have, you know, a month of just bad down spiral emotions and then unnecessary drama. So one thing can lead to another. And in national team, you can control the microorganism a little bit better, you know, because it's a smaller period, so you can grasp it. Did you want to say something?
No.
Where did you grow the most in the last 3 years as a coach, like from this progression and now to winning the Leaders Cup? Like, basically, what do you feel like as a coach that you progressed the most?
Working on me and working on the team and working on the clarity of what I want. Mm-hmm. I would say every year I try to circle around of everything we have done. And of course, I want to add a lot of ideas. But the first thing we do is like, okay, we wanted to do this and we did this. And where are we not where we want and why? And so, and I'm start digging on those points first. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, if I want to be a good offensive rebounding team and we're not, I will go check every league with every team who are the best. And gonna, you know, do like some clips about them, how they do, what's their system, trying to see what we can do, what we can implement, and especially with the new roster, try to do this. So I think in the last 3 years, this part has been big, where I've been able to work a lot on this, and I've started to go big on this during the COVID. Because we had a down moment without competition, so I start taking everything and trying to go deeper into this. So I would say that's the first one, and the second one is I got a bigger staff in Le Mans than I used to have in Vichy, and I had also that experience with the French national team to have a bigger staff. So I would say in the last 3 years, with the two summers with the national team and now this year with Le Mans, that's something I like a lot, to manage and develop also my staff. So I think that's also an area where the experience have helped my growth.
So those are interesting things. Offensive rebounding I wanted to talk about, but first the staff. What are some non-negotiables for you with the staff, and what do you think is the bigger challenge? The bigger the staff gets, how do you allocate the roles that they're supposed to have? How do you how many roles do you allocate to the coaches? What kind of mini jobs do they have in the macro job versus micro job?
I would say the non-negotiable is sincerity and authenticity. Like players, they see when you play a role and you're not what you act. So you need to act right, and it means that you understand that your purpose is to help the team and help the players, and you invest in this. And after, in terms of relationship, we need to be in a safe space. So working in the sports business, it's entertaining, but it also have to have like some closed doors into when we talk about players and so on. So I would say that's the two first thing with the assistant coach and the staff. I want them to be real, and I want them to be also really sincere. And after, I want them to have like some important roles during the week. For example, some video presentation, even if it's about strategy, I want them to be part of it. Mm-hmm. Because we need ideas, and to be able to bring up some ideas, I think that the staff need to have an open space. Because if you always on top-bottom system, they always waiting for you to take the lead, and they just become followers. And I don't think it's enough in a 10 month season, because you will have some down moments also. I don't believe in the superhero coach moment, right?
Yeah. It's funny because the last two coaches I talked to also were talking about the same thing, the investment of the staff. You know, like that you have to give the feeling to the staff that they are contributing to the project. You know, the project
has to be real, not only the feeling. I think that's the steps that we need to go to. Like having the feeling is good. That's the beginning of the year. That's the preseason. But after, they need to have a shock and understand that they're really part of it. And if they're not doing their job, we can't perform. And it can be in different areas, on the final results, but also on the daily work that we putting down with the guys. And if somebody's role is to develop the vitamins of like those three or four players, he needs to embrace that role and be the best in that role. And we try to do this. That's not always easy, of course, but that's a goal.
Yeah, that's what Brad Stevens also says all the time. Be a superstar in your role. You know, like everybody and Joe also talks about it all the time. You know, like you have to be a superstar in your role, whether it's coming off the bench or to the players, but also the staff. Whatever your role is, you have to be the best at it. And whether it's video presentation, I remember I was in a situation where the lacking platform within the coaching staff, because I was the youngest guy, but then I fought for one platform where I could at least present the players, the roster to the players, you know, where it's a separate, then the assistant coach and me exchange chairs. It's like a little bit of an exchanging in like a time that's kind of weird, you know, during the video mm-hmm. session. But I think it was necessary also for me to have a voice in front of the team, to show the team the little details of each opponent they will face. But then at the same time, it makes them comfortable and me comfortable talking to them on the floor. Because if I'm a mute all the time, if I'm just going to be a staff member that's going to be the shadow of on the staff, and then go on the floor and be a shadow, then I feel useless in an extent. You do the dark work, you do the dirty work in the back, but then at the same time, you also want to talk about it because you watch it all the time. You have knowledge that you want to share. And so relaying the message also kind of, it creates a passive relationship with the players that becomes active on the floor. Because they hear your voice already, they kind of know, and they feel that you have the cadence. It becomes more natural, you know, instead of just having a guy. Everybody, what I'm trying to say is everybody has to feel that they're a part of it. And then also, like you said, it has to be a real hands-on part that's kind of, it's you can grasp it. You can see the work that's put in that makes the players also trust you because they see that you know what you're talking about.
Yes. But at the same time, there's boundaries. Like the gesture, the posture of the assistant coach has to be also something really special. And I don't think that you learn that job because in all the coaches, clinic or all the teaching about coaches, they try to give you coach's license, but you never learn the job of being an assistant coach. And that's really particular. And I think that you can evaluate like really high level assistants when you see that their posture, their gesture, their wording is really precise and really adapted to the people and to the moment. And that's really high quality. That's high standard for an assistant.
Yeah, I agree. The posture, I can say it's an undervalued skill. You know, that you, you know this, and a lot of people that listen know this, I'm a freak of communication. like verbal and nonverbal communication are the two things that people have to differentiate. And it's not, and again, it has to be authentic. It cannot be like you're shown, like, nodding head. You have to be transparent with your emotion, and the players have to feel that you're also authentic and you're a person. You know, we're at the end, we're all people, but you know, you also, the way you stand, the way you talk, the way you express yourself, the cadence of your voice. So the mix between verbal and nonverbal is very important in the communication, especially as an assistant coach, like you said.
Yeah.
Hey, so we had a small technical issue on this part, and I'm here to announce personally that ProBalls.com is our sponsor for this episode and this podcast, a loyal sponsor, I might add. And it's one of the biggest statistical platforms on the internet. If you want to go nerd out on stats, on any kind of teams that you want to follow, you can follow them, and you're always going to have the up-to-date results on your website. So go to www.proballers.com, follow your favorite teams, favorite players, lots of nerdy searches you can do, and just go to work, all right? Chop it up on proballers.com, and see you soon. But in terms of scouting, and I wanted to touch on it because I looked at the box score beforehand, the offensive rebounding, you won the offensive rebounding battle in that game, and you had less turnovers, so you won in essence. Possessions matter, right? But on offensive rebounds, the tag and up system that you also use, but at the same time, what's the, like, how is that becoming like a most used tool for coaches now around Europe? Isolo used it, and French national team using it. I see it more and more that tagging up, it's becoming a little bit more of a is prevalent in Europe.
More than 10 years ago, I went to a clinic about like the U19 national team. And the coach at the time, Frederic Rappez, he made like a statistic analysis about like the team who are leading the offensive rebound and the possession. And he showed us that Team USA in every categories, they're taking back more than 50% of their missed shots. And for us, that was a path. Like as soon as he say that, I say we should compete as with the French national team and in every categories, we should compete with the US. And so I've started digging and searching what people are doing. And the first thing I liked was like, before we would say everybody was like attacking the offensive rebound with a triangle. And it can work, and it still work, and there's still plenty of team doing it. But I was more big on say, okay, let's say we can go nobody and play the transition defense going back, or we can bring everybody. And when we can bring everybody, how can we do to make it understandable and clear enough? And how do we react to every situation that the opponent can do against this? So, of course, I've I've went into a lot of clinics, information, and after I started doing it with Vichy a few years ago, and that was a way for me to say, okay, we got the youngest roster of the league. Perhaps we don't have the knowledge and the experience on the half court offense, so we got to have second chances. And we also have to not refuse open shots because we got a strong rebound. We are tracking expected shots. So we can pass away a shot that everybody expects in offense. So there's a link in between the shot selection and playing the tagging up system. And so we started building on this. And I think also players like it because extra possession, if you take offensive rebound, that's good for your personal evaluation, and getting more shots is always fun. Like all the players loves getting more shots. After the goal, perhaps for us is to get more efficiency from those offensive rebounds. I think we can do better, but it helps us. It helps us compete. We got perhaps the smallest roster in terms of size in the league in Pro A, but we're number one in offensive rebound. And so that's something we are proud of.
Can you sum up the tagging up system for those who don't know, just in layman words, in terms of so they understand the visual concept of it?
So the main idea is to have everybody playing the offensive rebound, but playing in an organized way. Everybody is playing high side, high tag. So it means that you go coming back to the middle of the floor and you tag, so you impact the players in front of you, but you don't beat him. You want to push him under the basket. This way, all the defenders are like closest to the rim, and after you can take long rebounds thanks to that. And secondly, because it's possible in Europe, you can go over the back rebound. And or you can tip over because you're coming from far, you got speed, you got intensity, so you got this. So that's the main idea.
Yeah,
so you can win, and you can win two times with it. You can have extra rebounds, and also if you're losing the rebound, because the opponent going to take rebounds too, of course, and when he takes rebounds, you're already set up to put pressure on the ball. So it transfer to a transition defensive transition system
with pressure,
with big pressure. Yes.
Yeah. And the thing is that, especially with the French physical tools, the French bodies, the French athleticism, that makes you compete at even higher level. You know that everybody is like that. Just the tipping the ball, just the length of the players matters already. And that's in that situation, that's kind of marginal. You know, if you're 2 meters away or right there with the guy, you're already in an advantage.
But it gives you also IQ, because you need to read the trajectories. You need to impact with angles. You want to have consistency in that. So you need to jump from one status to another really fast and as a team. And I think that's really interesting to like use your physicality on purpose.
Yes. Yeah. It has to be, there has to be purpose behind it for sure. Yeah.
Like you can see in the NCAA tournament, Houston is really big on crashing the ball also, but doing it a little bit differently, but the goal is the same. The tools are a little bit different, but the goal is the same.
What is your approach on scouting other teams versus scouting your own team? And where do you put more emphasis on?
I would say I'm more a coach who work more on his team. Like I would say 70-30.
Okay.
And because I'm I want to develop my team. I don't think that we, and especially in a competitive league like the Bet League, we don't have the best roster at the beginning of the year. And that's not missing respect to my players saying that. There's some big, big names in the French competition. So we say, okay, we need to have a directory as a team. And so we need to invest time into that trajectory. And I would say perhaps the more the year goes on, the more you can do some adaptation. But I would say we're spending more time working on our A plane.
So self scout over opponent scout.
Yeah, I would say a little bit more, but we're becoming more and more big on players' quality. To give more info into that, because there's a lot of situation where it's going to be matchups against good players and also mismatches, and people need to have the info to be able to take care of those one-on-one into the 5-on-5. And after, we're more working on the situation than on the plays. Mm-hmm. Like, we're using the plays of the opponent, but more as a tool to repeat our defensive system.
And for my job, from my perspective, you know, self-scout, scouting a team, scouting an opponent team, you kind of also, you learn about other players at the same time. You maybe fall in love with some players. You kind of see the things that you like. How do you gather, what do you put emphasis on gathering intel on players? You know, like where do you feel like are most like trustful sources, and how do you determine of which sources you can trust?
You mean in the process of recruitment?
Yes.
Yes. So we try to have a three steps way of doing. First one is statistics.
Statistics, yeah.
Statistics, yes. Where we track a lot of players, and we try to define a profile and see where they are in terms of percentile in their league. For example, you see somebody who is a good three-point shooter, and you say, okay, where is he standing in terms of best shooter in his leagues? I like to have this, and also this way we can reduce the number of guys that we are looking for, and then we are tracking films, so videos, and we want to have we're making our first self-scouting about the players. And then when we reduce, then we're going to jump on getting intels. And we're going to get intels from players, from sometimes scouting services, sometimes guys have been around the NBA process, so there's a lot of intels around them. They have been in Europe in teams, you know, stuff like this. Mm-hmm. And after, we're going to try, say, okay, these players, that's for sure, we are one phone call away from somebody who has played with him, played against him many times, be in the same league or something like this. So we try to have people of confidence, and this network in Le Mans is thanks to my sports director, Vincent Loyo. He's been there since a long time, so he got a big network. So it's really easy to get some good intels. And also, we have kept a lot of good relationship with players, so it's easy to also ask them. And I think that players take a lot of pride of helping in this, because I think it gives them value also when they're doing it.
Mm-hmm. Is there a certain player type that you see yourself infatuated with? I like that word. Is there like infatuation with a certain player type that you, when you watch, that you kind of like, you feel like you can use the best?
Yeah, I'm really big on effort in intensity. I like when the players are in that type of situation. I think it connects them to the crowd, to the fan base, and it gives energy to the team. So I think that when I start seeing people who can give it all in multiple ways and multiple situations, I think I'm giving a deeper look. And after, I would say perhaps is the off ball, giving gravity to the game, and not only shooters, of course it's obvious when you see Steph Curry running around that he's giving gravity with his off ball movements, but good cutters And perhaps it's even more impressive when a kind of non-shooter or somebody so-so shooter is a good cutter, because it means that people are perhaps not really close to him, not over denying him, but he find ways to open a third dimension to the game. Because for me, it's really something that it's going to redevelop in our era of basketball, because the two-man game have been king during years and he will steal it. But the movement around and the movement without the ball, I think is the key that's going to develop in the next years.
It feels like yes, a lot of emphasis on activity.
Yes.
Activity, effort, cutting, running off screens and movement. So it's definitely something that's more modern type of basketball that obviously the Golden State Warriors with Steph and with all this, the way they changed the game, the way he changed the game, kind of it feels like there is a lot of too, because it creates space also and creates shots for others, not only for, yeah. for him.
And if I can add something on this, is people are most of the time disconnecting intensity from IQ. But I'm a true believer that taking high-level decision in a high-level competition with high intensity is a really hard skills. And there's a lot of players who they're not going to be able to play in the way the game is moving, the direction is taking. But there's some guys with, of course, the potential, the athletic potential need to be here, but what's going to separate them from others is the decision-making. Because you need to play with that intensity with a really high-level decision-making. Like when you see TJ Short playing, everybody can say, okay, he's too small to play at that level or so ever, but he played that fast with that level of decision-making that even playing Real Madrid is killing the game. And that's really impressive for me to see those guys who bringing this. And years after years, they keep developing in areas people were pointing, okay, but he's not good at this. Okay, he can't shoot. But yeah, but this year he's 40% at three in EuroLeague. So...
Yeah, there's always nitpicking. You know, if you see some weaknesses, you can definitely find them, and you can talk yourself into the weaknesses. But can you talk yourself into the strengths as well of a player that are overwhelmingly, you know, better or higher than the weaknesses? Everybody has some weaknesses, and you can justify any kind of decision you want to make, pro or con. But sometimes you have to be realistic in terms of how. What impact the strengths have versus what impact the defense, the weaknesses have, and some players are just, it's mind boggling.
Yeah, but you're right. But I think like focusing on the strength is a key point to build up relationship and also to create a situation where, okay, I know that I'm gonna play around my strength. And so people can ask me to develop or to hide or to compensate what I can't do. Yeah. And but that's a really important thing with players. And sometimes, especially after a bad game of one player, we see all black and we don't want to see anything good. And that's important to have that day where you step back a little bit from the team. And when you come back, okay, you have put that game into the perspective of the season, of the perhaps of the career, of the potential of the players, and then you can work around it.
What do you do to decompress? And you say like stepping back. What do you do usually after games?
I try to do something different with my wife, and try to walk, try to eat, do something, discover something. Sometimes binging a series, a TV show. But it has to be something a little bit different. And sometimes we need to schedule it, because the basketball schedule is that tight that if you don't schedule it, you're gonna keep working and and perhaps not be really precise on the time you allocate to it, because there's always something to do. Mm-hmm. And but if you put some real time, quality time, I think it helps you manage people better, because perhaps you could do something technically, strategically with the time you allocate to something else, but when you step back a little bit from the intensity of basketball, I think you got a chance to reconnect to people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Have you heard of my B8 summit that we're organizing in the summer?
Yeah, of course.
So Vincent Collet is also coming, as you know, and I was wondering, now I can take a chance also to advertise for it at the same time, but also ask you what you think would be the best topics to talk to Vincent Collet about.
I think the spacing and decision making are two key points, and he always find ways with his teams or with the national team. No matter how many time he had, he always find ways to build up a system who's going to be flexible enough to adapt and answers all the problems that the opponent can put on the floor. And I think he's really big on this, on that teaching, to help the team develop being like a problem solver. I think he's big on this. Like, for example, perhaps you're going to have a short playbook, but in that short playbook, people are going to go every place to answer all the problems and jump back on the right spacing. And I think he had some really different teams, sometimes playing with two bigs, sometimes, and he had to mix it up. And I think he always find smart ways to maximize the potential of the French national team.
For sure, it was very. I scouted. We faced each other so many times. So scouting the team year by year, summer by summer, and then seeing, you already see the options developing, because they read and react basically to every, from the same situations. They have key decisions that they make, because it's just a simple read for the defense. If the defense goes this way, you do this. If the defense, and it's always very simple, but also at the same time with the French national team tools, with the execution, with also the emphasis on those little details, it got better and better every summer in terms of executing and finding the gaps and finding the obviously early on in my career was Boris Diaw being the decision maker. So you have you have one of the best passers and the best readers and the high IQ players that can make those decisions on the fly. But, you know, that helps the next generation to come up and see. And it always was keeping it simple, but then execution was perfect.
Yes. And it was at the same time a system who can answer to the competition and be able to bring you at a stage where you can compete for medals. And at the same time, it was a system ready to incorporate new players and really click on it really fast. And I think he did a really good job of keeping the roster in constant evolution during all those years. And that's certainly why he had that consistency into the result.
Yes, for sure. What's something that we can talk about off the court? Because I know communication, he's big with communication and some public speaking appearances also. But is there anything you feel like off the court that would be valuable for people to know his opinion on?
I think on individual feedback, how you help a player to develop and empathize and understand on what key point he needs to do better. And he is really, I think, big on those moments where he had those feedback when the guy is just there, and that's not prepared feedback. It's live feedback, but in a down moment, and it take time to exchange with the player to get answers from the players. So I think that's he's really skilled on this. And a lot of players, we can say, for example, Nicolas Batum and all those guys, he helped them so much.
Yeah. No, like you said, it was year by year, summer by summer, it was like a natural transition every time. There was new players had to be implemented, yeah. And it finds a way. You know, it's just like a system that kept on working. So, yeah, everybody, you know, who's interested, b8summit.com, Vincent Collet will be there. And I'm really excited. It's getting closer. You know, the closer it gets more exciting. So, and at the same time, it's, you know, first time like that in Lithuania. So, certain amount of responsibility comes with it.
Sure.
Are you ready for my ATOs?
Yes, of course.
I'm not going to draw, but I'm going to give you some quick hitters. Best advice you have received as a coach?
That the more you give, the more you receive. And it was more in NGOs called Giving Back, and was my mentor Babacar Sy, who told me that. He said the one who gives is the one who receives the most. And I realized it when we were making some donation, working for humanity and helping an orphanage, and you can realize that it's changing you forever. Mm-hmm. And so you are the one who gives time or invest money, but at the end you're the one who receive the most, which is perhaps a little bit unfair, but it's also, I think, really beautiful. And if you transfer it to basketball and in the building relationship, in building with your team, I think is the same. You can't be in a situation where you expect others to give you and not giving. And so if you want to be a leader, you need to be the first giver.
Interesting. Yeah. Advice from your current self to your younger self.
To keep going, to keep the faith, and because it's really an opportunity job, because there's a lot of things down the road, but you can be professional even when you are an amateur. It's only a question of like building your own habits and everything. And I've been coaching since I'm 18. I'm 42 now, so it's 24 years of coaching, and that's my first year in first division. So it has been a long path to arrive this. And for me, we can keep working on it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I would say keep pushing even in down moments, because there have been some down moments, of course. So keep pushing.
What's the hardest and the most undervalued part of coaching?
The hardest part is how bad you can feel about after a loss, because sometimes it's really not appropriate. And sometimes that feeling doesn't stand on you that much, because you got the next competition coming, and I think that's really good. But sometimes it sticks to you, and you need to be able to separate you from the basketball coach, because if you don't, you feel miserable.
Mm-hmm. Best worthwhile investment for yourself in the last 12 months?
Investing sometimes to building relationship, activate relationship, and being able to go to the summer league. I think that was a good investment. And after, I'm also working in every year, going deeper in some aspect of management. So getting some more courses and everything. So, yeah.
Courses, in terms of online courses you do?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. When do you know you're pushing yourself too hard?
It's like for the players. I would say you adapt to everything, so you can push yourself harder. And after, you need to get some limits when, I don't know, you see impact on how you sleep, how you eat, how you are with people, and especially how you are with the people you love. When you feel that that's not right, I think you need to adapt or go for a run and come back on your feet.
Exert yourself.
Yeah.
Biggest pet peeve as a coach and as a person versus coach versus person. You know what I mean? A biggest pet peeve?
No, tell me.
Pet peeve is something that it irks you, like you hate it. You know, something that really gets under your skin as a coach when you watch players. Or for me, for example, I cannot go to a cafe and sit at a coffee table that's wobbly, you know, that's always shaking. I have to either put something, I have to change the table. That's my biggest pet peeve in a cafe.
I would say with players, when I have the feeling that a player could have done more and more intense, and that he's quitting a little bit situations, and I don't like that. And after in life, I don't know. I don't have like something jumping into my mind right now.
Easy going person. I try to. Your favorite failure? It's my Tim Ferriss question that I have to ask everybody that you failed on in the past and you feel like was the biggest lesson to you and you actually appreciate the failure.
More than 10 years ago, 2011, middle of the year, they fired the head coach. I was the coach of the U18 in my team and they put me into that job. And I think I was not ready and I was not ready to deal with the roster I have also and with the economical situation of the club. It has been a nightmare all season, really hard. After I stopped coaching like team basketball the year after. So that was a tough one. But during the year after, I went a full year into helping the NGO I was talking about. And also going for MBA at a business school. So it helped me build back my energy and come back with a new purpose. And I think that the failure have waked me up because I was not where I wanted to be. So it pushed me to go like harder on me.
So personal education is the answer to everything. I think it opens up so many more doors.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thanks for being here.
No, thank you.
It's really, really a good conversation with an easygoing person. It's always easy to talk to. So thanks for being there.
Thanks for your time.
How can people find you if they want to find you on social media somewhere?
Yeah, on Twitter. With my name, Guillaume Vizade.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Simple. All right.
Simple. Easy.
Easy. All right. Thanks for everybody for being here.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye. Bye-bye.